You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 2nd of August 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Belarus fails again to win friends or influence people. Iran braces for the consequences of its apparent drone attack on a tanker. And does anyone really need to learn Latin? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Holly Dagres and John Everard will be here to discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have the latest in our series looking at the Olympics from a variety of national perspectives. Today, America's favourite pastime. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined today by Holly Dagres, who is a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Middle East programs and also edits the Iran Source as well as MENA Source blogs, and by the former British diplomat John Everard. Hello to you both. Both voices familiar to our listeners from our recent Foreign Desk historical series, he said, plugging it gracelessly. But I do want to ask you both, because there is an Olympic theme throughout this program, how agog either of you are. I will start with you, Holly, for the Olympics. Did you spend all this weekend, as I may have spent some of it, getting massively into freestyle BMX?
Unfortunately not. I mean, I was really hoping to watch more of the Olympics this year, but really work has gotten in the way of my enjoyment of the Olympics.
You can do them both at once, I have found.
That's true. I did watch the skateboarding. I thought that was interesting. That's the newest sport to be included in the Olympic Games this year. And I really enjoyed that, actually, because it was just something random and fun to watch.
John, do you have a niche Olympic obsession?
Yeah, sleeping through it. I've never really got into watching sport. I like exercising. I'm a keen cyclist, as you know. But sitting there watching it, I just don't get. And I just let the Olympics slip past me.
BMX freestyling is on bicycles?
It is indeed on bicycles, but I do feel watch live cycle racing. I tuned out of the Tour de France even, so BMX doesn't really cut it.
You're a tough man to please. We will start today with a compare and contrast exercise with two Eastern European countries, both frequently criticised for authoritarian overreach. One has furnished a demonstration of how not to handle a potential PR crisis, while the other has provided a masterclass in taking advantage of a rival's mistake. At issue is Kristina Timanovskaya, a Belarusian sprinter, who made some minor criticisms of her coaches on Instagram, to which Belarusian Olympic officials reacted by bundling her to Haneda Airport and attempting to force her aboard a flight home, creating a major international incident. Poland has now granted her a humanitarian visa and refuge at their embassy in Tokyo. John, you have been an actual ambassador, indeed an ambassador in Minsk as HMG's man in Belarus. In a similar circumstance, would you have flung open the embassy gates and taken in a promising sprinter?
I don't think so. I mean, the British embassy in Minsk is really quite small, and she'd had to be quite a short sprinter to fit in. I have been in embassies where the embassy gates have been thrown open, notably to Chinese dissidents, one of whom famously spent 6 months sleeping on the embassy squash court to the horror of the embassy squash players, protesting firmly that she was persecuted, couldn't speak a word of any foreign language, and had to be got out. When we finally got her out, she boarded the aircraft, and the first thing she did was to turn to her accompanying official and said, in flawless English, could I have some champagne, please?
How do you get somebody out of your embassy? This may come in handy one day for any Ecuadorian embassy officials who might be tuning in.
Yes, quite. It's not easy, particularly if the host country is determined to keep somebody in that embassy, or ideally have them handed over to the local police. In the end, we cut a deal with the Chinese authorities. She'd been there for just too long. It was all getting too embarrassing all round. And she wasn't quite of a seniority where they were going to fight in the last ditch to stop her leaving China. So she was allowed to quietly slip away.
Holly, to return to the matter at hand, and this is an entirely rhetorical question, how dumb are the people running Belarus and its Olympic Committee? Because this is a thing which I'm sure happens within every team at every Olympics. An athlete tees off about the coaches in private or in public. Had they not made a fuss about it, literally nobody would have noticed or cared, and they have managed to create a major international incident out of it.
Certainly. I mean, I think there's always banter between athletes and their coaches, and the fact that this has become so publicized is what's drawing attention to it. But I also think it's noteworthy that this isn't the first time that an athlete has defected or decided that they're not going to go back to their home country. There was actually numerous incidents over the decades. I think the earliest incident was actually in 1948 in the London Olympics, where a Czechoslovakian athlete had decided she wasn't going to go back because her country had become a satellite country for the Soviet Union. And so she stayed, and she ended up staying in the UK, I believe, and moving on to the US at some point to teach physical education. So, I mean, it's not just them. Even the Iranians have athletes that have defected. We had five Iranians, or we do have five Iranians on the refugee team. So this isn't unprecedented, I would say.
This doesn't seem, unless this is something she had been attempting to engineer, as far as we know, like a deliberate defection at this point. If we take it at face value until we know better. John, you've had better insight than most into the logic by which tyrannies operate. You were also the ambassador to North Korea, as regular listeners will be aware. From their perspective, does this make any sense? Does creating an enormous flap over something which you would think any sane country would just go, huh, what are you going to do? Does it make any sense?
Making a flap makes no sense at all, but that wasn't their objective. I think the missing bit of the jigsaw here is that we had some very frightened Belarusian sports officials. They had fouled up. They had not got the relay team through the doping tests, and they were about to have a relay with insufficient athletes. They were panicking, and then Kristina goes and criticised them on Instagram. They knew they were in trouble. Remember that President Lukashenko of Belarus is obsessed with sport. If you go to the presidential webpage on the Belarusian government site, which I'm sure you do regularly, you'll find there's reams and reams of stuff about how many gold medals Belarus has won in different Olympics and so on. The man really focuses on it.
So the Olympic Committee is headed by a certain Viktor Lukashenko.
That's right, yes.
Yes. Let's see if we can take a wild guess as to how he got the job.
Can't we just? But so I think their objective was to quietly bundle the troublemaker onto a flight back to Minsk before she got them into even deeper trouble. And from their perspective, of course, it all went horribly wrong.
So you think this is more a case of just panicked bureaucratic backside covering?
Yes, I think it is. I think they were trying to shut her up. I think they were trying to stop embarrassing Instagram posts before further incompetence was exposed. And like I said, it went wrong.
Holly, what seems to you to be Poland's angle here? I mean, it may be a straightforward case of just genuine humanitarian outreach. They may be thinking it's only 3 years to Paris and they're trying to beef up their relay squad. Her husband, apparently, is also en route to Poland via Ukraine. But is Poland also perhaps trying to put one over on Belarus here?
Very well might be, but I think that would also lead to a diplomatic incident in a way, if that's really the case. I mean, it's really hard to say. There's not enough information. Like, I think it's interesting that the borders were actually closed and her husband managed to actually cross over to Ukraine. So there's a lot of information we're not seeing just yet. I think we're going to have to wait and see on this one.
Okay, well, let's continue with what appears to be today's theme of diplomatic spats. Here in the UK, the Foreign Office has summoned the ambassador of Iran for what is likely to have been a brisk conversation concerning last week's drone assault on an oil tanker in the waters off Oman. The attack killed two members of the crew of MV Mercer Street, one of them British. The UK, the US and Israel have all blamed Iran for the attack, with the kind of certainty usually associated with having receipts should they be required. Iran inevitably denies everything. Holly, is there actually much doubt than that anybody but Iran did this. This is not the first attack on tankers in the Persian Gulf in recent weeks and months, but the casualties among the crew have so far been mercifully unusual.
Yes, yeah, so I would say this has been going on for some time, actually since 2019. Israel and Iran have been in this shadow war where oil tankers and commercial vessels have been attacked over the years, but this is actually a significant incident because the fact that two lives were lost, and one of them was a British national. And so what we're seeing here is actually an escalation almost. It's not at that point, but I think it's noteworthy that Iran doesn't have a nuclear agreement that's set with the U.S. They're kind of at the dead end right now. The assumption is that Ebrahim Raisi, who actually is going to be inaugurated on August 5th, that his new administration would actually take over and take the helms over of the nuclear deal and then finish this these talks in Vienna. But the reality is that this is a lot of tit for tat that's going in different directions. And we've heard the Israelis and the Iranians say that they will take rightful action if necessary.
Just to follow that up, if it is Iran behind quite a lot of these attacks on tankers in the Gulf over the last couple of years, and that seems, let's say, a reasonable assumption, what's in it for them? Where does Iran see the mileage in this campaign of harassment as being?
Well, for them, this all started with the maximum pressure policy that was implemented under the Donald Trump administration when the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear accord in May 2018, and that was despite the fact that Iran had not violated the accord. And so the more that these sanctions were imposed on the country and the more they felt the more they were isolated, they were actually looking for different trigger points. And actually what we seem to be seeing is that the Israelis actually turned things up a notch, because as Iran actually sped up its nuclear program, it was looking at different ways to actually slow down its involvement in the region and its nuclear nuclear program itself, hence why we've seen these nuclear facilities attacked through sabotage incidents, and also Iran's top nuclear scientists assassinated in November of last year.
John, to return to your first-person diplomatic experience, this matter of an ambassador being summoned, I have a question in two parts, which is, one, were you ever summoned, and two, what goes on at a summoning?
Was I ever summoned? No. I came close, but was never actually summoned. So what goes on to summoning? Although I personally wasn't summoned, I have accompanied other ambassadors who were summoned, and you get a dressing down. Usually the host government is sufficiently angry that they will just, you know, read a piece to you, telling you how wicked your country has been, and then, you know, hand the bit of paper across just so that your reporting telegram gets the exact wording right. And if you've been given instructions to say something, reply, you do. Otherwise, you simply smile politely and walk out of the door. Famously, if you are summoned to the Foreign Office here in London, you know you're in real trouble if you're not offered a glass of sherry. That is the killer signal.
Does it strike you that this will have been a meeting without sherry?
I think this might well have been a meeting without sherry, yes, sadly.
Well, of course, depending on the Iranian ambassador, they might take even graver offence at being offered sherry.
Well, yes, maybe they offer a soft drink. Maybe the Foreign Office has modulated its response to ambassadors since I left.
Holly, this is a diplomatic pickle for all concerned. Even if we assume that Iran did not actually intend to cause injury or death among the crew of the ship, that is always obviously a risk you run when you start driving drones into oil tankers. Both the UK and the US are going to feel obliged to respond in some way, but they both want to keep the Iran nuclear agreement on track, don't they? They don't want to give up on it. They want to find a way to reincorporate the United States into it.
I think we actually saw the response already, which was Secretary Antony Blinken actually condemning the attacks and blaming Iran, and then the summoning of Iran's ambassador to the UK. I don't think it's going to go beyond that, because I think that they recognize that much is at stake with the nuclear talks, and that they recognize diplomacy is the only way forward to actually basically stop these incidents, these tit-for-tat events between Israel and Iran, because essentially this is all tied to the nuclear program at the end of the day. So I think that's really what we're going to be seeing here, is just wait and see once Raisi gets his cabinet going, which is going to probably be sometime about mid-September.
Just finally on this, are there perhaps grounds for optimism here in that maybe if we take as read that Iran was not actually intending to cause death or injury, that they might appreciate that they have somewhat overdone it here and therefore wind it in a bit for at least the foreseeable future?
It really depends, because if the Israelis decide that they're going to do another sabotage attack, maybe on another nuclear facility or take out somebody, I don't see that they're going to slow things down anytime soon. They're going to feel obligated to respond again.
Ollie Dagres and John Everard, thank you both very much for the moment. You are listening to The Monocle Daily. We'll have more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. Another core principle at Allianz is a belief in equality of opportunity and that diversity makes a company more innovative, more resilient, and better equipped for the future. Matt Stutzman is a Paralympic athlete, a decorated and world record-holding archer, and a man with a remarkable personal story of courage, resilience, and the single-minded pursuit of excellence. Matt Stutzman is here to tell us more about his story. Matt, what kind of support do you receive? What about in terms of mental health, in terms of building and reinforcing resilience, confidence?
I believe that mental health is extremely important. I believe that in order for you to obtain the goals that you're trying to get at, everything that you got going on in your life has to be at peace. What I mean by that is like, you don't have any family stress. You know that your bills are taken care of. You're not wondering how I'm going to pay the bills. Like, you have to be completely just, everything is okay. And that will allow you to get that mental to the next level. And for me, the help that I get, it allows me to just participate and do what I do, because I don't have to worry about, you know, how the kids are going to get food or how the bills are going to get paid. And I can just literally focus on what I'm there to do. In my opinion, it's probably the most important thing. That is what's going to determine if you are going to perform your best or if you're not going to compete very good at all. It is more important than picking up a bow and shooting it. It's more important than that skill. Like, you have to be mentally strong and in mentally good health. Otherwise, all that training and practicing that you did, it's not going to work at the end of the day.
Athlete and inspiration Matt Stutzman on how he takes courage for what's ahead, no matter what. A clear passion, one that matches Allianz's own passion to secure people's lives. Allianz, confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests, Holly Dagres and John Everard. This past weekend, there have been protests in France, and we'll pause right there to allow guests and listeners alike to collect themselves after fainting dead away with shock. While it is indeed the case that flinging bistro tables at the gendarmes is to the French what going for a nice walk is for the rest of us, the recent brouhahas, or bruise-haha, whichever is right, have reflected something of the general zeitgeist in that they are motivated by indignation at the idea of any kind of health pass which permits people vaccinated against COVID-19 access to things forbidden to those who decline a vaccine for reasons which may not be related to ignorance or lunacy, but you could be forgiven for betting with form at this point. John, a nice leading question to start with for you. Is there any reason whatsoever to take these dingbats seriously?
Well, yes, because there are an awful lot of them, and last time France didn't take dingbats seriously, and there is no shortage of dingbats in France, as you'll have observed. we ended up sort of with graffiti scrawled all over the Arc de Triomphe and a nasty mess in central Paris. So it's wise to take them seriously, even if they are, you know, patently wrong, and even if they their position is quite clearly not supported by the wider French public. The France Info, the radio station, I think 2 days ago, did a poll which showed 75% support for mandatory vaccinations for health workers and 60% support for demanding COVID passports for going to restaurants and cultural centres. So these people are quite definitely a noisy minority.
Holly, if you are in charge of a country in which there is such a noisy minority, and most people running most democracies are at the moment, this is not a uniquely French phenomenon. Is there actually a response you can make to their objections beyond tough luck?
I mean, I think the real question is, like, how long are we going to be mandating these passports and how long are we going to be having these expectations? I think the fact that this is becoming normalized is what's worrying some people, that this isn't, yeah, there are people that think COVID's a hoax. There are people that think that you're going to be able to get Wi-Fi off your arm and all that stuff. But I think the big question is, like, where do we draw the line on the future if we're going to do this? Like, we should have a deadline at least so that people can feel comfortable and that this isn't normalized and this isn't what we're going to be living like for the rest of our existence.
Is there something to that, John? The idea of setting some kind, Mike, that was a massively Australian pronunciation of kind there. I don't know where that came from. Is there something to be said for setting some kind of date, even if it's not an exact one? I mean, the obvious argument against that is that setting deadlines has made fools of several governments over the last year and a half or so. But is there something to, as Holly suggests, saying maybe, look, if everyone does the right thing now, then maybe this time next year, life will be more or less back to normal.
If you take that view, you are effectively saying that you think that the virus can be beat back into the background. And I'm not sure that many epidemiologists believe that. I mean, we're moving from pandemic to endemic. You know, coronavirus is here to stay. It's going to be with us for the rest of our lives. Given that, no, I don't think you should put a deadline on it. I think you should square up to people and say, for the rest of your lives, you are going to have a COVID injection once a year, and you are obliged to do so in the same way as the state requires you to pay your taxes. This is a social and political obligation on you. You have liberties, you have freedoms, you also have obligations to the rest of the society in which you live. This is one of them.
Holly, is it something that might take care of itself more or less if more and more employers, and there are already plenty of them, who are starting to say in their capacity as private companies that this is a condition of working here?
I think it is. It's getting to that point. I'm even seeing universities in the U.S. that are mandating vaccines, and I think we're going in that direction because people are recognizing, well, if I don't have my workers vaccinated, there's going to be an outbreak and I'm going to lose all my workers. So there's more benefit than cost to getting everyone vaccinated, or at least hoping that this this situation improves itself once we have herd immunity and everyone vaccinated.
John, where are you on the idea of incentives? There have been variations on this all over the world. Most recently here in the UK, Uber, Bolt and Deliveroo are going to offer incentives to young folk. It does seem weird that, you know, £5 off a pizza is somehow a better incentive than free protection from a potentially deadly illness.
It does seem odd, doesn't it? Where do I stand on this? I'm all in favour of a rich mixture of carrots and sticks. Yes, you have to do this. And also, if you do it, hey, you know, £5 off a pizza or $100 if you are in the right place in the United States. I think that the way that a few companies have stepped up and been quite imaginative in the incentives they offer is quite encouraging. Let's see if it works. One that we haven't yet said, let's get it out of the open, is that so far, Macron's approach has worked spectacularly well. The vaccination rate doubling in France from 350,000 a day to 650,000 a day, creeping up there to vaccination levels not so very different from those in the UK. It's quite a coup.
Now, nunc let's voltus procul and judicere excitando educationem mate ad latinum aut ad popularium multitudines. And if that's wrong, and let's face it, it is, blame a combination of Google Translate and the fact that I didn't go to one of those fancy pants schools which teaches the otherwise unemployable children of the British upper classes how to bluff their way into power. The Prime Minister of this country did, however, and now his government proposes to spend £4 million on a scheme to teach Latin at 40 state schools. Gavin Williamson, who is Education Secretary for some reason, has said he wants to make Latin less elitist. Are there, he said, squinting at the table, any Latin speakers here? Ah, John, you disappoint me. If we come up with the one language you didn't speak or don't speak.
Well, I don't actually speak it, but I can read it.
I knew it. Where did you learn to speak Latin?
In one of those fancy pants schools.
then you seem a good person to ask, John. Is there a value to learning Latin, do you think?
Yes, there is a value to learning Latin. As Mary Beard, the famous Oxford classicist, has said, it puts you in contact with a rich cultural heritage. It enables you to know more about the classical world, which gives you a broader perspective on the world of today. I don't think the problem is that there's no value to learning Latin. There clearly is. It's a question of relative values. Given that even school children only have so many hours in a day, how are you best going to employ that time? Is teaching them Latin more important than teaching them more mathematics or more physics? And in the end, it's one of those unanswerable questions. Some people are going to respond better to learning Latin than to other subjects. Others aren't. It's going to vary a lot from pupil to pupil.
I mean, I will out myself at this point and say that for reasons surpassing my understanding, at one of the non-fancy pants state schools I went to, I did actually get subjected to a term of Latin and enjoyed it absolutely enormously. But then I'm massively in favour of just learning for the sake of it and the acquisition of knowledge useful and otherwise also for the sake of it. But Holly, to Gavin Williamson's point that he wants to make Latin less elitist, and this is a perspective of somebody who has spent a long time in this country struggling and failing to understand the class system, but isn't the point of Latin that it's elitist? It's a kind of code that these people, like John, talk to each other in, isn't it? I mean, my point being, if the peasants start trading quips from Seneca and Horace, the upper classes will just switch to, Phoenician or something, won't they?
I mean, I think, yeah, that could be one way of looking at it. But I also see it as a gateway to more languages. I mean, if you learn Latin, you're able to conquer a lot more of the Romantic languages. And I think it can help you with understanding the English language as well. But I see the point here. Like, what is the point? Where does this get you in life? And but if they recognize the fact that it is benefiting elite schools and they want to pass it on, maybe there's got to be some use in it, or else why would they give that opportunity to regular schools? I don't know.
I mean, I do. The wider point I do think there is here, John, and this is where I think we will agree, because I know you speak several languages, whereas I only speak one, though we did both grow up on monoglot islands. And I just wonder if countries like this one and Australia generally fail to take languages seriously enough. There's something about being an English-speaking island. Like, it still drives me nuts that in Australia, kids at state schools from the age of 5 are not learning to speak Indonesian and Korean and Vietnamese and Chinese and Japanese, because that's where we are in the world. But they're not even learning European languages. They're not learning anything terribly much.
I agree. I feel quite strongly that we have to take learning foreign languages much more seriously. Tragically, the era when you can simply speak firmly to foreigners in English and they understand has passed. If we are serious about being a global nation, then we are going to have to speak global languages, including difficult ones, including ones that you have to struggle a bit to get on board. The original excellence of language scheme, remember, was Mandarin. I've been running since 2016, and it looks as if Latin has sort of been spun off that. Hasn't been a tremendous success. When we talk about effectively the government's levelling up agenda, sort of trying to get state schools to offer something that so far has been the privilege of private schools, we throw £4 million at it, we get 40 schools involved. There are about 3,500 secondary schools in this country. We get another 40. So far, the Mandarin programme has reached 6,000 school students out of about 6.75 million. There's a certain amount of tokenism going on in both projects.
John Everard and Holly Dagres, thank you for joining us. Finally, we will end today's Monocle Daily with our ongoing series on the Olympics. For the duration of the Tokyo Games, we're getting some of Monocle's international staff to reflect on their favourite Olympic moment. For today's instalment, we turn to Monocle's Chris Chermak as he looks to one of his home nations, the United States, and back to 2000 when Team USA won gold in baseball for the first time by defeating Cuba.
I've always liked an underdog in sports.
Run, Forrest, run!
It's part of the reason why, when it comes to the Olympics, you'll find me far more likely to root for the athletes who share my Austrian nationality rather than my American one. My favorite story of these Tokyo Olympics? That would have to be Austrian cyclist Anna Kiesenhofer. Her gold medal in the road cycling event was so unlikely, so audacious, that the Dutch cycling favorite behind her crossed the finish line thinking she had actually won herself.
Oh, Ruud, I had it mis.
So when it comes to picking iconic Olympic moments from my other half, my American half, I could have easily picked the 1992 basketball dream team of Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, Patrick Ewing and Larry Bird. But that would be obvious.
Here's a 3-on-2, Pippen!
Of course the dream team was going to win in 1992. There may have been no bigger favorite in the history of Olympic sports. So instead, I'm going to tell you about a different national pastime, one where the United States are something of an underdog in a sport that they claim to dominate. That would be the sport of baseball.
America, what's your favorite sport?
Baseball.
Sandwich.
Hot dog.
Pie.
Apple.
And what's your favorite car, America?
Chevrolet.
It's understandable that you would think baseball is a sport that's dominated by the United States. That's partly our own doing, of course. After all, we do officially call the finals of our domestic baseball league the World Series, as if no other country in the world measures up to our own domestic prowess. Or to quote the British comedian Eddie Izzard, America's won the World Series every year? Well done, America.
Take me out to the ball game.
Okay, so maybe we're a little prone to exaggeration. The reality is that baseball is more international than many of us Americans care to admit. It's a testament to the growth of the sport that baseball and softball are back in the Tokyo Olympics for the first time this year since 2008.
The diamond, and they've done it. The United States is going back to the Olympics.
The favorites this year? The home country of Japan. This year's Olympic hosts, Japan, along with Cuba, are the two biggest names in international baseball competition. Cuba won the first Olympic baseball event in 1992, beating Taiwan in the final. The U.S. came in fourth. Cuba won again in 1996, this time beating Japan in the final. The U.S. took bronze. And it's not just the Olympics. Japan was the winner of the first two World Baseball Classics.
Nikita gets the strikeout, and Japan with 11
That's the baseball equivalent of a World Championships, which was launched in 2006. The U.S. and our vaunted Major League stars, we didn't even reach the semifinals. To be fair, we do also like to shoot ourselves in the foot. While many domestic leagues, including those in Japan and Cuba, are halted to let their best players join the Olympics, North America refuses to do the same and halt Major League Baseball. Remember, they're competing to win the World Series, after all. All of which is why I remember this moment from the Sydney Olympics of 2000 as something of a genuine underdog story. This was the sound of the first Team USA victory in Olympic baseball. A 4-0 win in the final over, you guessed it, Cuba. This was a U.S. team made up of a ragtag bunch of amateurs and young upstarts, led by veteran foul-mouth manager Tommy Lasorda.
Hey, Mike! Do the job!
Damn it. Son of a...
Lasorda was a legend in his own right, who had won two of these coveted World Series titles as manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers. But the team he was leading into the Sydney Olympics was nothing of the sort. Sure, some of the players would go on to become stars in their own right. Players like Ben Sheets, who pitched a complete game shutout in the Olympic final against Cuba, and fellow pitcher Roy Oswalt. But at the time, they were plucked from relative obscurity. The players that their professional teams weren't afraid to let go and risk getting hurt in the hunt for a trophy that wasn't the World Series. What's heartening about this story is what it meant to the players and their manager. Tommy Lasorda would later say that winning the Olympic gold was the best moment of his life, that it meant more to him even than his two World Series victories. The Olympics might often play second fiddle to domestic title pursuits in American sports, but the players felt something different. There's something about playing for your country, not as a dream team, but as a motley crew of underdogs that you'll never forget. And at the end of the day, isn't that what the Olympics is all about? For Monocle 24, I'm Chris Chermak.
Thank you, Chris. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Holly Dagras and John Everard. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye and thanks for listening.